You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
René Ngabije is the Rwandan-born Namibian author, editor, publisher, photographer, literary educator, and entrepreneur. His debut novel was The Eternal Audience of One and was honored with a special mention at the inaugural Grand Prix Pan-African de Literature and won the inaugural African Literary Award from the Museum of the African Diaspora. His new collection, he calls it a literary mixtape, is Only the Stars Know the Meaning of Space. Thank you for joining me, Remy.
It's a pleasure to be on your podcast. I really do appreciate you making the time and the effort, Rick.
Well, this is a fabulous book. It is so amazingly well written. It's just a joy to read. And what intrigues me from the get-go is what you call a literary mixtape. You have photos in the beginning of piles of cassettes, handwritten. Yeah. I mean, this is something that I have from, and I admit that I have 40-year-old cassette tapes of Depeche Mode, the 12-inch singles I made.
Yeah, no, the designers at Scout Press were very in tune with the work and what I was doing and what I hope to achieve. And the fact that they went with the cassette tapes for me spoke volumes about how much they invested in my work, because cassette tapes for me were the first things that you could transmit music to someone else in a medium that they could use easily. So I remember how cool it was to make mixtapes and how they were a currency on the playground. Ooh, you've got this person's mixtape, you've got that person's mixtape, how they were a way that you communicated friendship. And also, I remember just how on Valentine's Day, getting a mixtape was the coolest thing. Like, you could record all of these very cheesy 90s, early 2000s pop rocky things and like send it to a girl that you liked, and that would communicate your romantic feelings to them. So I guess it was like this idea that, you know, a mixtape is something that you put a lot of care and effort into. It's not flippant, because it takes a lot of time to record songs, to copy songs. So it's always communicated to me some aspect of personal care being put into it. And so when they went to the cassette tapes, I was like completely thrilled.
You know, this is the way you put this book together is really fantastic. It's inventive in every way, in terms of the form, the way you thread the stories with A-sides and B-sides, and we'll talk about that. And also just the fabulous, wonderful, evolving language you use. You have a lot of fun with the way you write and the style you write. Is this something that came to you like, sequentially? Did you like think, okay, I'm gonna write this book and it's gonna be like this, or
I wish it was sequential, because sequential means that you go from point A to point B relatively quickly. It never really happened that way because of the nature of the project. I wasn't writing a novel that goes from start to end. I was putting together this collection of short stories, so all of them came to me in different times and in different ways and forms. And really the hard part was, once the idea of a mixtape was finalized in my head, how it was about to go around making separate parts fit together. And not with the intention of making it like puzzle pieces that must fit 100% together, but more of like bringing similarly emotional, geographic, temporal stories close to each other, or arrange them in such a way that the reader then does their own mathematics to try and piece the detective story going on behind, the story going behind together or by themselves. So it revolved, it was really not sequential. It was very haphazard and very confusing to me as well. If I could show you my notes, and how erratic and chaotic they were, you'd be very surprised. But I think that goes with the way, with the form. I was breaking a lot of rules, using a lot of forms that would not ordinarily be associated with storytelling. And so to bring those into close, to try and create a medium in which you bring them close together so that the reader then has like enough material to be like, oh, does this thing in this story relate to that situation over there? Or, oh, is this what happens in this time period and that happens over there? And then at the end, you get like, oh, so this is what's been happening throughout in the background, and now everything makes sense. Trying to work towards that aha moment was very hard and messy.
You know, that's one of the things that makes this book so much fun. For me, I think, in a sense, all fiction stems from, what we call the mystery genre. You start out, you start reading a book, and you wonder, why am I reading this? Who is this person? What's going to happen? And in a mystery, it's kind of that thing. And with this, the mystery is, who is this person? Why is this story being told this way? And it's really a joy to put together the two parts, also to see the evolution of the language, of the character growing up. And you capture a very interesting time. Your character is just about to turn 30, and I think that in at least the 21st century here, turning 30 has a lot of analogs to what we would call the teenage years, because when you're turning 30, that's when you're finally starting to figure stuff out.
Over here, I think 30 represents different stages of life on different parts of the world. So over here, 30 in the continent in Africa, 30 is seen as an age where you are grown, where you've had your teenage years to be irresponsible, your 20s, you should have spent building a career for yourself. And then when you're 30 is really what we call your empire building days. This is when you're going to go from junior to mid-level to senior management. You're going to either start a business and it's going to be lucrative. And when you reach that 30 stage and you still have a little bit of doubt or a little bit of confusion, it's heavily frowned upon because you must know, because over here, the price of not knowing is often at the economic cost of someone else. So, for example, you have people you must support, you have extended family you must look after, you have very real, tangible, heavy adult responsibilities. So, by the time you reach your 30s, at least for us on the continent, you're very, very mature, forcibly mature because of the responsibilities you have to take on. But I think about it in the global context and how at 36 now, I feel like this is the maturity level I should have been when I was 30, because I'm thinking about my 30, turning 30, and I was like, I did not know anything. And I'm thinking about the character in the collection, just under how much emotional pressure he is to be something that I don't think he is ready to be. I mean, I always say that in your 20s, you're always only working with your with the best available information. And then in your 30s, it seems like the same things that happened in your 20s come around again, but you've had a second crack at them. It's like, wait, I went through this when I was 24. Let me do this. Whereas in your 20s, everything is raw and it's happening for the first time. But I think the language of the character, I think he's not yet quite there. He's maybe a little bit behind the curve because of the things that have happened to him in his life. But I hope through the writing and the reading that they see that, you know, he and his friends and his family, they are on the path towards discovery. And whether that discovery is life-changing or not is really up to the reader to decide. But it seems to me that they've gone through the woods, they've been lost a couple of times, but maybe now with the changing of the language and some maturity and some grace happening, maybe they arrive at a place where they're now going to be on the path that sets them right. At least that's the hope. I do not know. I really don't know, Rick.
Well, one of the things that I really loved about this book was the language. And I'll just have to say, Shout out. I love that early on your poetic character loves alliteration.
Oh.
So, Doc, I mean, that, as I understand it, and alliteration is often frowned upon, but I enjoy the hell out of it, and I love that your character uses that. So, talk about just making these kind of like choices. There, it's a different ways to show, maturity of the character with the language. And I think it's beautifully done.
So I grew up and I learned English in what we call the formal way, where you go through the figures of speech, you're taught all the figures of speech and how each one of them works, how to recognize them in literature, and then that's pretty much it. When I was going through, I think late teens and early 20s when I was at university, it shocked me how much in literary things that we were reading, the language seemed kind of bland or just very all the things that we were taught that make speech colorful was suddenly being taken out, and everything was realistic and everything was realism and everything was just dark and cold and gray. And I'm like, but there has to be another way of communicating things. And so for me, one of the things I rely heavily upon was, the influence of music, particularly hip hop in the early 90s and the late 2000s, is that it's got a rhythm. It's got a way in which like bars and paragraphs and stanzas are organized. And I always loved that. Unfortunately, I have never been given the talent to rap. What I have is a gift, I think, for language and a particular way of writing, and the use of alliteration or assonance or any of these very onomatopoeic modes of writing. Those have always made sense to me because that's how storytelling also works on the continent. It's not just the sun came up. It's, oh no, the earth bent down and the sun did a pull up into the sky. It's like very metaphoric and esoteric ways of describing things. For me, that's always felt natural because it colors our language and it really differentiates how you talk between a group of friends who can understand each other's shortcuts and metaphoric language, and how you speak to your family who might know other ways of communicating with, and how you speak to strangers who you might be formal with. But for me, using figures of speech has always been like, I think of them like spices in a spice rack. If you're cooking this curry, why are you just going to use salt? Like, why not some turmeric? Why not some cinnamon? Why not this? Why not some rosemary, some sage? And then see what you wind up with. Just and figure out the right mix and the right thing. And then over time, the more you start doing that, then you start discovering or landing on like spices that you'll use more often than others. For me, when I was using this, I was very clear that I wanted the language to sound very lyrical, to have very particular rhythms, moving from joy to sadness, from introspection to outrospection, from one person speaking gracefully and kindly to another versus one person using very harsh, very hurtful language. I was aware that I wanted the reader to have different flavors and spices within their ears as a way of like, oh, this is this character speaking. Oh, that is that person going through that. Oh, this is describing this situation in which people are trying to find love and hold on to love. I really wanted to be particular about those things.
One of the things that I thought worked really well was when you just immerse yourself in this, it takes a while to figure out these two threads. So talk about making the decision to tell one story in the A sides and then to tell a series of, stories that kind of reflect and refract off the main story in the B sides. That sounds like you are just having a lot of fun. As a reader, it's a lot of fun to read through it and discover what you're doing.
That's so generous of you, Rick. Thank you for saying that because honestly, up until I finished everything, I was anxious about it. I was scared that it wouldn't make sense. And I think having fun in the process of writing it was an important lesson for me to have as an artist. Oftentimes, as an artist, you're told, you must suffer, you must sweat, you must cry. This is like giving birth or whatever. But I can't lie to you and say that I had a lot of fun writing these stories, A side and B side. Certain stories more than others. But the idea to create that, I'm not really sure where it came from. I just know when I looked at like the finished works, I said, yo, I didn't even realize that they're two separate things that tie with each other in very interesting ways. In my world, I was just like writing 22 very different short stories. But then when I put everything together, I was like, oh, this is what's happening, man. This is so it was an accidental discovery that I wound up leaning more into by accident. But once I started leaning into it, then it became fun. Then it wasn't painful. Then it wasn't like, where are we going? Then it's like, let's cook this up as best as we can and see who gets it. And then it's been wonderful to have conversations about people who've read it, who then say like, oh, I felt this. And I'm like, I didn't even think of that. But now that you mention it, it makes sense. And so like what you're talking about, like it gives me comfort because it also gives me hope that we can continue creating different kinds of books. Not just the one size fits all, not just a novel, not just a short story collection, but that you can be adventurous within the form itself, which is for me, I think very important because the world's always looking not only for new stories, but for new ways to tell stories, new ways to enjoy literature. I wanted someone to have a book that they could open, and wherever the page opens, there's a story they can read and they can close it and they can be done. But I also wanted one where they're if you have a little more time on your hands, well, why don't you read these in so-called sequential order, but also read them in a haphazard order and then see what narrative and what you get at the end. I really wanted a book that a reader would have an interactive reading experience with, not just sitting back and reading from cover to cover, but putting down, going to do something else, and then coming back and be like, this feels different than it did an hour or 2 hours ago. I really wanted something different. And I wasn't sure what I was working with until it was finished. And I mean, a generous reader like you giving me this feedback means a lot to me because it means I've achieved some of what I wanted to do. And that's that for me. I'll take it. I'll take it, Rick.
Well, this makes me think that, that the experimental novels, so to speak, in a sense, all novels are experimental, and all stories that we want to tell are experimental. I mean, if you read something like Bram Stoker's Dracula, I mean, it's just a collection of letters and news stories and a bunch of stuff, and I think, my God, that's really weird and kind of and it felt to me when I first read it, and it still does to this day, very experimental. And this book really captures the joy of being completely free within the form. You basically say, I'm going to do this my way, and I'm going to tell a story the way it feels right for me to tell it. And that's a really interesting approach. Now, let's talk about your main character. He wants, unsurprisingly, he's a young man who wants to be a writer. But he has lots of relationships with lots of very interesting women that work out differently. Talk about creating this voice. Did you create him sequentially, or did you like experience his life like I guess I'm thinking of Slaughterhouse-Five of time out of order?
Definitely not like Slaughterhouse-Five, man. It's because if it was something like Slaughterhouse-Five, it would be the writing experience would have been a lot easier. No, I think the character has wants and desires that I think a lot of people will be able to empathize but also sympathize with in both in their successes and in their failures. The aspiration to be a writer, I think, is something that a lot of people will have at some point, or to be an artist rather, is an aspiration that many people will have with. For him, he's clearly been groomed by his situation to aspire to that. He's a private school boy who went to an elitist institution, who's been exposed to elitist high culture, I guess, if you want to call it that, highbrow culture. And so for him to want to be that seems very natural. Unfortunately for him, he's in a situation that does not necessarily provide a clear roadmap to it. So I like to think that if this guy lived in the UK or or New York or something else, it will be a lot clearer about how he goes about being said writer. But unfortunately for him, he's not. And that confusion about what you want to be, not being existing where you find yourself, is something that I was very, very interested in exploring. But then also beyond that, there's what he wants and then there's what he needs. I think what he wants and what he needs are in opposition to to each other. He wants to be in a relationship with his girlfriend, but he's not doing the emotionally mature things that he must do in order to sustain the relationship. He's clearly suffering from a deep traumatic loss in his family. And what he needs is closure. But the things that he's doing are like walking away from said closure. And so there's this very, very big gravitational destructive pull between what you want and what you need and how it plays out in his life. But then also, just also, there are moments where I think, when I'm thinking about it as a reader, when I read it, when I've tried to approach my work as a reader, there's disturbing moments where you're aware that this character, this person, is not dumb. They're very aware of the choices that they're making. And some of those choices are self-destructive. And so it's a question about, like, well, you know, are we all aware of the decisions that we make and are we prepared to live with them? And for me, that was an interesting thing to explore about the choices that we make and whether we are present and patient for all of them, and whether most likely we've already accepted the bad decisions that are going to come from this poor choice well in advance. So for him, there's certain things that he needs that must be taken care of in order for him to have a happier life, be a better human. But he'll make very strange decisions that steer him in the opposite direction. And it's like, why would you take the long road when there's just do this thing and you'll be better? But I think that's also a reflection of our humanity. Sometimes the simplest choice is actually not that simple, and we have to suffer to get to the right path. And wisdom does not come to us easily. And so for him, I think he's smart. I think he's witty, but Lord knows I would not take advice from this young gentleman. Yeah, and I think it was also very clear for me that I wanted to write something that shows the difference that age does to people. So Rambo's approaching 30, he's smart, he's witty, he's clever, he's charming, but the flaws that this young man has are not. You can see how, for example, the older characters are shaped differently by time. And for me, it's also a way of, like, not paying homage, but respecting the way that time shapes us, how much smarter it'll make us, how much kinder it could make us. And also, he's scared about turning 30, but he's not aware that, you know, when you reach your 30s, you'll probably be a little more patient, you'll be a little calmer. And when you become 40, you'll maybe be a little more patient than you were in your 30s. And so he's scared of leaving a particular time frame of his life, but he's not understanding that each epoch will come with particular challenges and gifts. And part of aging is learning to put away the things of your youth and growing old gracefully. And just like, yeah, I'm not that age anymore, but that's fine. There's things that I'm going to do now that I wouldn't be able to do at 28 or 25 or whatever. I'm 36 now, and there's things that I can do now that I could not do at 35. And for me to learn how to grow old, you know, I'm approaching 40, and it's again, it's this other big thing that's very big on the continent. What are you going to do when you turn 40? I'm 4 years away, but I'm learning that the things that I achieved this year at 36, there's no way I could have done them at 34. I had to be this age in order for them to happen. And so now it's like curious about what does time hold for all of us? And why are we not always looking forward to the future? I think there's a cult of youth that we all have to escape at some point and just learn to grow old.
Wow. Well, I have to say you've acquired quite a bit of wisdom in a short amount of time. When I was 29, my motto was I'll ram six beers at the end of the Elvis years. And that's what I did. Now, one of the things I love about this character and about this book is it feels really universal. I mean, it unfolds in a world that is, vastly different from the kind of life that I had the fortune to experience. But I felt like the characters I could absolutely recognize, the humanity, as it were. Yes. This is the time for me for when I'm going to make some really bad decisions. And if I'm fortunate, I will learn from them, or maybe at least survive them to learn from them later. And so talk about especially his viewpoint towards his relationships with women. I think you do a really good job of showing that tension, the way men and women look at things very differently. And you do it, what's nice is that you do it from within the man's point of view, but yet by virtue of the strength of your writing and the words you choose, we can understand what the women are thinking.
So I think the first part of your question about how we all live vastly different lives is true. Geography plays a very big role in what kind of life you're going to have in the world that we live in. Where if you're born in the US, you're going to have a particular kind of life. If you're born in the UK, you're going to have another one. Australia, South Africa, Nigeria, Kenya. Geography plays a very, very big role. However, due to globalization, cultural imperialism, streaming services that are the same the world everywhere, where there are certain similarities that we will have. Music, for example. You will know the Eagles and I will know the Eagles. Why do we both know Don Henley's music? Because all of us grew up with radio around us sometime. You in a different era, but me as well. So even though we're separated by geography and time, we will have the same cultural or artistic sensibilities just because of what our class has, for example. I was very aware that I'm writing about a character who's in this part of the world, but I wanted to also make it clear that just because we're based here in Africa, in Windhoek, in Namibia, wherever you might find yourself, there's certain human things you will go through that are universal. Confusion. Confusion about where your life is going. Confusion about what is love and how do you hold on to it. Confusion about friendship, what friendships are nurturing and which ones are not. Confusion about choices that you have to make. And then also not being strong enough to live with a choice that you've made. Not being smart enough to, quit while you're behind. These are universal things that you will go through regardless of geography. And so when Rambo, for example, when we're talking about his relationship or the tension between the women he's attracted to, for example, and the women who show him love in return, those are important things to highlight in the work because those are also the things that lead one to his possible redemption, but also his self-destruction. This inability to discern what you are attracted to and what you actually love is something that I think is going to be or plays a very destructive role in the lives of men. And I'll narrow it down and say men on the continent. We're very conditioned to gravitate towards things that I don't even know. I'll say shallow things or shallow aesthetics or shallow ways of life. But the things that make your life enriched, that make your life wonderful, are actually a little bit deeper and you have to work a lot more. And part of like learning to fall in love is in a lot of ways learning to let go of the shallow things of your youth or that you've been programmed to like. And so for him, The shallowness is like a shell that he has to break out of and realize that, oh, this is what real love is, deep romantic attraction that you're willing to sacrifice and give things up for. And I think it comes through from the female characters in the story, because I think for them the risks of loving are a lot clearer to them, are made clearer to them earlier. I think men can faff around and be more irresponsible for a longer period of time based on the geography that I live in. But I've seen and I've observed that women, from where I live and from the way I've experienced it, they learn to love a lot earlier. And Rambo, who's this character, is not on the same maybe maturity scale as some of the characters in the collection. But that's also like the tension about how, his love interest is ready to build, is ready to sacrifice, is ready to this, that, and the other, is patient, is willing to work through trauma. Rambo is just like, I know what I must do, but I don't know. It's just like, bro, like, be serious. And I think those tensions are something that we've never examined deeply within our communities where I live. It's not something that's spoken about within my community. I mean, it's a miracle that we're in the new world in the 21st century where I can have open conversations like this with my male friends, which is a wonderful new space in which to be. But I can think about in my 20s how stunted I felt because I'm like, who do I speak to about this? Who do I converse in a very open and frank manner about these confusions in my life? Like, I want to go down this road, but society says you must do this, my homies say I must do that, but like, this is what's materialized in my life and I really want to go to this thing. Where do I find the courage to do that? There's no roadmap. And I think in the collection I wanted to also be clear the way that it's structured that there is no roadmap. And I think one of the take-home messages is that love isn't something that just comes to you. It'll make itself known, but you need to have the courage to walk towards it and to do the things that you must do in order to hold on to it. I think about the mom and the father's relationship in the collection. Those are clearly people who are more mature, who are smarter, who have realized, like, regardless of migration, regardless of loss, regardless of economic hardship, we are going to make this work and build and pour from the same cup and everything else. But you can see the generational shift between the parental figures and the younger, how fleeting attraction is, how transactional romance can be, and how love almost seems like, oh, it's fashionable now, but it's not fashionable in a year's time. And it's like, no, it's trying to reach a stage where you're like, you need to go through all the processes to actually realize, to become a person worthy of love, to become a person who's fighting for love, who's person who's willing to like hold on to it and pay whatever price they have to pay in order to have this thing that is so rare and important in the world.
You know, one of the things that I love about this book is the shape of the stories. This podcast is called Narrative Species because I see humans as a narrative species. We define ourselves. I ask you, who are you? You're going to tell me a story. And I love the shape of the stories in this novel. This literary mixtape, as it were, because it's somewhat chaotic, but within the entirety of it, it's chaotic, yet it comes together really beautifully. And the shape of the sub-stories, because we experience our life as kind of not just as one big long epic story, but as what we did this day, what we did with this person for the next 2 years. And so talk about and a couple of the stories that really just grabbed me from the beginning was the first off, let's talk about the love story of the gangster's girlfriend, which is just like it's such a so much fun to read because it's just like, oh my God, how dumb am I? I'm that dumb. Yeah.
The shape of stories is an interesting way to put it. And for me, I wasn't really constricted and saying this story must look this way. I was more interested in like, I want the reader to feel this. I want them to laugh at this and then be disturbed. I want them to first be angry and then work towards a point where they're like, okay, I get it. Or I want them to start in a place where they're delusionally happy, and then by the end of it, they are objectively happy. It's like, oh, this is why I'm happy. So I wasn't, the shape of the stories was really not something that I paid too much attention to. I knew the structure, like I knew one would be shaped by a grocery list. I knew one would be shaped by the grandmother and her eight lovers. I knew one would be shaped by these different stages of a human life. I knew one would be told through the couches or the pieces of furniture that are family owned. I knew those types of things. But the shape, I would rather say, I knew the flavor I wanted to impart to the reader. I want this aftertaste. That's a good thing. I want this aftertaste. I know you're going to bite into the gangster's girlfriend. And first, you're going to be shocked by one, the violence. Two, that despite the violence, there's still space for attraction. That even after that attraction, there's still romance, and even something possibly deeper, despite the overarching presence of violence within the story. There will be elements of humor that you will laugh at until you'll be like, wait, what am I laughing at? Or there'll be elements of seduction where you'll be like, wait, but that is violent. I really wanted that was probably one of the riskier stories in the collection, and it took the longest time to write because I was very aware of the stakes that are involved. You didn't want to glorify the violence, but you also had to be honest and sincere and realize that this is a reality for a lot of people in the world. And so the character, the gangster's girlfriend, who happens to be in a relationship with a woman who is in an abusive relationship with her boyfriend. So it's like this love triangle of three parties, each of which are, I guess, lacking a particular kind of power. I was very fascinated with that because the main protagonist sees himself as being better than the girl's gangster boyfriend. But when you look at it from far, you're like, well, it's in the grand scheme of things, you're not courageous enough to do the right thing in this situation. You also lack the maturity to see the forest for the trees. You also not taking advantage of, but you're willing to go along with the flow. And you're not actually doing something tangible that changes this situation around. But at the same time, the love interest in that story has a lot of power over both male characters, has a lot of, is very aware of the emotional, physical investment both parties have in her and is able to navigate or not play the game, but use the situation to her own advantage. But that was such a disturbing story in which to write. And because when he came to me, I was shaking. I was like, are we really going to write this? And then it was even after I decided we're going to write this, I was like, how are we going to write this? And even if we do, will it make sense? Or will it be misinterpreted? But that for me was an important thing to write because I felt not all romance or attraction is going to come to you in the way and shape that you want it. Some of it will be gritty, and you might have to polish it a little bit to get it to where you need it to be. And you might succeed, but you might also not succeed, and you need to come to terms with both possible outcomes even before they materialize. Scary, yeah.
Scary, one of the things too I loved about this was the variety in it. There's a story of some of a homeless, wouldn't
Yeah.
really call them a gang.
Yeah,
Talk
yeah.
about create. I absolutely adored that story. I just thought it was wonderful. It was terrifying, but it was beautiful. And I love the way you created the characters in the absolute worst circumstances who really truly care about one another. It's just
Yeah.
amazing.
No, I mean that story, the neighborhood watch, when he came to me, homelessness is like a very big thing around the world. We have a lot of pride that is attached to home, and homes are where families live. And families are like, we've been told are the building blocks of society. So I was curious about what happens when you do have a home and the family in it is broken. How is that really much better than being cast out into the world by yourself? And so, in exploring these people and their lives, it was important to one, give them a sense of agency that the things that happened to them were not of their making. But despite being homeless, they have dignity and they have grace. And that's most importantly what we always forget about people who have lost homes for whatever reason. Is that surviving in a place where homes are everything and you don't have a house or a roof over your head? It takes a lot of guts and street savoir-faire to be able to survive on a daily basis. And so for me, it was important to bring that reality home in a way that does not denigrate the characters and their setting, but also to remind ourselves that. If these five people can build a little tribe or community for themselves again in a harsh, harsh world, what excuses do we have from the comfort of our homes with water, electricity, heating, air conditioning, nice carpets? What excuses do we have for being cruel and unkind to each other? They're like surviving in the worst, worst situations. And they still have the basic, I think, let me not say that they are 100% perfect people, but they have commitments and allegiances and particular levels of loyalty towards each other, kinship, if you want to call it that, that I have not seen in more stable family structures. So it's a question, it was also a question of like, what is the value of our homes to us? And if you are cast out into the world and you lost your home, would you still have the same level of grace or decency or kindness? I doubt it. Would you be able to survive if you didn't know where you were going to sleep that night? I sincerely doubt it. What about food? What about common acts of dignity like showering? Body odor is like a thing that's frowned upon. But what happens when you don't have a shower? How do you still form a community when you don't have these basic amenities of life? The Neighborhood Watch was also one of those. Again, a very disturbing story when it came to me because I was like, oh, I'm going to write this. I had to find a structure. I based it around the refuse collection cycle of Windhoek because I've seen this rubbish truck come around regularly. But most importantly, for a very long time, I started seeing the people who follow, not who follow, who precede the rubbish truck. Because they want to be able to go through the trash and before it gets picked out, looking for valuables to make the sort of like life. And when that story came to me, it was also a case of like, well, you're going to have to be very responsible when you write about this because, again, the stakes are very high. The consequences of misrepresentation are very dire for that community. And for me, one of the challenges was just finding the right language, the right tempo, the right way to bring the story out into the world. That for me was important. Yeah.
It was truly beautiful, and that this brings to mind another amazing story where you tell the entire story in essentially one sentence.
Yeah, Annus Horribilis was. So I think as an artist, there is a part of your practice, or when you're a particular age, or you're working on a particular project, when you're like in The zone. You've hit this impossible place where everything feels like everything you touch will turn to art, and it just makes sense. And once you're in that zone, it's very rare, but once you're in it, you know you're in it. And oh my God, when you create in that zone, you're in the flow. Annus Horribilis is also, again, another tough story about a couple who's having possibly one of the worst years on record in their relationship. And it is told, the entire story is one sentence. And when I hit that stage in the collection or in my publishing history, I'm not gonna lie to you, Rick, I was on a roll. The flow was here, the vibes were everywhere. I just felt like nothing can stop me. It was that, I think you call it the invulnerability and invincibility of youth. Oh, I was, no, I just felt like, I remember when I started writing, I was like, it's gonna work. I know this is gonna work. And then only now am I looking at that story and I'm like, how on earth did I even pull this magic trick off? But again, it's also being given the freedom to break form, to do something that you've never tried before, and having the space to do it. And most importantly, also having the skill. Because that's another thing that I think maybe we don't give a lot of credit, a lot of writers credit for, having the skill to do that impossible thing. For me, I knew I wanted to tell this entire short story in one sentence, a very long sentence, of course, that's broken up into different clauses, but that one that a reader will be able to be like, wait, am I still reading this one crazy sentence? I wanted to do that and I wanted to be deliberate about that. But it was also, Rick, I'm not gonna lie, it was also like an artistic statement to say, like, I think you all need to read African literature with a little more generosity because we can do amazing things with language. It's not just New Yorkers or Los Angeles writers or Chicago writers or London-based writers who do crazy things with language. It's like we do some amazing things here as well. And so it was also, yeah, it was all of those. It was flow, it was rhythm, I was in the zone, but it was also like this impossible thing, I'm going to show that it's possible. And I know it'll work. So that was also like not a statement piece, but a statement piece where we'd be like, I know this is a flex. I know this is a bit of a show-off thing, but every once in a while, you just have to. Yeah.
Well, I think that's one of the things about reading this book, as a whole book. We can sense as a writer that you, as a writer, are having fun, and that makes it really easy for the reader to have fun. And one of the real joys is as you go forward in the novel, particularly on the A sides, the character kind of seems to grow up a bit and calm down, and it's really just an absolute joy to think about, wow, this guy's life is coming together, and it makes you realize that one's life can come together at any age, in any way, in any time, as easily as it can come apart.
Yeah. I mean, isn't that the fragility of things? Things are working perfectly well for somebody in the world right now, but they're also going horribly wrong for someone else. In the same, on the same earth, in the same city, in the same street, under the same sun and moon. It's crazy to think about. And that duality of like fate is something that I think about as a writer, but also someone going through life. But on the page in this character's life, it's wonderful to see that something nice does happen and that he's aware that something nice is happening. And then the question is, well, will he be strong enough to gravitate to walk towards this nice thing? Or are we condemned to traverse the same path that we have in our past? But, things come together in a way, and you're like, well, will you have the strength to hold things together? Things can come together, but sometimes you have to hold them together. And I'm like, will you have the same strength? And so, Rick, I'm really relieved that you can sense that I had fun, because I think I did, and I hope the reader has fun when they're reading it.
Well, that's one of the joys of this book, especially going back and forth between the two sides, because you do show us some really tough things. There's a story about being a military male that would fit well within the horror genre. So talk about, one of the things I like about this book is that it's clear you feel the freedom as a writer to go where you feel like going, and that's where you're going to go, and it's all going to make sense as within each makes sense within each story, but also makes sense within the larger story, because this book captures the flavor of a life which isn't, one flavor. Life is a lot of flavors. Many of them, we would, if we had the choice, we'd go back and say, I'm not gonna do that dish.
No, I mean, important terminology for military age males was a story that, again, I had to dig deep into my research because I'm writing about a very sensitive part in Namibian and South African history with regards to the border war or what they call the Namibian War of Liberation. There's a lot of military terminology that I had to get right, but underlying that is a story of stolen humanity about how the people who partook in that struggle were dehumanized, both as victims and as perpetrators. And I think war does that to both parties. And so, writing it from the perpetrator side was about refining the right terminology to be like, I don't want you to think soldiers are robots. Soldiers are very normal people who have gone through a particular process in order to become what they are. And the things that they do and that they're asked to do and that they're ordered to and that they're required to do in order to have that status as a soldier, while it is disturbing for us as ordinary civilians, we live in a world where this is normalized. Like, well, oh, this is the price of freedom. This is the price of liberty, of independence. This is the price of fighting for a moral or idealistic cause. There's going to be some dirty, messy, gritty stuff that will have to go down. And I remember writing that. I'm just like, this is not a flavor of life people will want to have to deal with. But I am very aware that the things, the joys that we have in our life, the freedoms, the rights that we enjoy are not free. They are not cheap. They have been bought at like the highest price in the past. And so it was also a case of like, well, I don't want to write a story of just pure villainy. I want to write a story in which there are bad people who do bad things. And behind those bad things, then the reader has to question, but what kind of system allows these kinds of people to be created? You know, I want the reader to be like, wait, this is messed up. These people are just the embodiment of a larger system. That for me was important. And then again, even in that story, there's a deep plot line. Like there's a plot that runs through it that I think the reader, once they get it, it closes the circle not only there, but also closes a later circle in the later stories. Because there's a story, there's an underlying plot there that's also very dark and disturbing. But once you come across it, you'll be like, oh, snap, this is what happens over there. And you're like, oh, this makes so much sense. So I hope, I don't want to give it away. I don't want to be a spoiler, but I hope that makes sense.
One of the things about this book is it reminds me of the main character in one of the most famous novels ever written, which is to say, Frankenstein. And the book itself is like Frankenstein's monster. It's a bunch of different parts stitched together and brought to actual life. And so at the end, you're saying, my God, well, this is really weird and it's somewhat monstrous, but it's alive. Having created life once, what do you think you'll do next? I mean, this is a daring experiment that absolutely works. Are you going to rest on your laurels and write Pride and Prejudice?
So I wish I had laurels upon which to rest. The reality is that I don't have said laurels.
Oh my God,
What I'm
this just for a second, let's remind our listeners that you have founded all sorts of literary associations, literary prizes, in Namibia. I mean, it's a big deal. You're the Dave Eggers of Namibia.
Wow. Not Dave Eggers is a big compliment, man. I'll take that and I'll run with it. But I'll be sincere and say that I do not know, or rather, I know what I want to create next. And what I'm working towards is having the maturity and the skill to create it. Yeah, one work that is daring, that is highly risky and experimental is good. I'm not sure I want to do that again because. Also, there's a point where you also become known for a particular kind of thing. Even experimentation starts losing experimentation once you do that a couple of times, And so I was very clear that my first novel was going to be written a particular way, and that was risky as well. And then I wanted this one to just be like blow form out of the water. And I did, I think, I hope I did that. The next one, I'm not so sure. I'm sure about what I want to do with it, but I also want to offer something different. I think about all these bands and artists that I like is as an artist, you need to have the freedom to create what you want to create. You shouldn't be beholden to your audience. So I'd be like, well, they liked this album. Let me give them another album that's the same. No, explore new territory. That's what I'm trying to do right now. I'm exploring new territory with, I think, more mature subjects, not maybe mature subjects, but with different language. And I think I'm on the path, but I'm not 100% sure. I think I'm in the ballpark. I just have to see, just give it a couple of months to see where I wind up. But what's next is more of the same, brother. More writing, more reading, a lot of reading, because that's important to the craft. Hopefully more traveling because I've realized now how different geographies help to spice up your writing. Hopefully more traveling, more encountering more artists, more writers, not even more writers, just more people involved within the arts who do different things. But even beyond that, just ordinary people from different geographies living their life. I think those things are important for writing as well. So hopefully more adventures, man. What else can really, what else can one hope for? Yeah, more adventures. I mean, look, writing made me, you and me meet. We wouldn't have met if it wasn't for writing. And
There we
so
go.
I hope it brings us more, brings me more people like you, man.
I've been speaking with Remy Namije. His new tape is Only the Stars Know the Meaning of Space. Thank you for joining me, Remy. This has been a delight.
No, Rick, thanks so much for making the time, and I appreciate it, and you, brother.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.